You know, it's a funny business. Speaking of, since we are here, do you any of you know the term feeling rank? Well, now that's a term that horse players use. People who dig horses, but the same phenomenon holds true in people. And when a person feels, I don't know whether women ever feel rank, do they? I didn't think so. It's impossible. It's more's the pity. I'll tell you, more's the pity. I'll say that. But nevertheless, that's a funny business. We're all living here. We're fooling around, and we got all kinds of things hidden down there in the wastebasket of our mind. We got Treasure Island. Remember Treasure Island? I remember one scene from Treasure Island. It emblazoned itself on my very faulty memory as a kid. It's like a bad picture I have. But it's very clear. And some bad pictures are clear, you know. Some of the worst pictures I've ever seen have been clear pictures, actually. And I see the scene of somebody climbing up an anchor rope. And they were climbing up an anchor rope in the darkest part of night to get aboard this vessel, which was in the harbor of the island, Treasure Island. What was the name of the ship? I'll give you the brass figligy with bronze oak leaf palm. What was the name of that ship? I remember one time, speaking of ships, you know, it's funny how you get into... It's hard to look at your own life as an example of what is going on in plays, fiction, and in movies, and in TV dramas. You know what I mean? Do you ever look at your life, things that happen in your life, as being truly significant of a society or a time or a place? Or do you only look upon, say, characters in plays as being significant of a society or a time or a place? In short, if you're going to take a character that's significant, let's say in time and place, he represents a kind of thing. There have been always universal characters like Shrike, good soldier Shrike. He represents the little good man caught in the machinations of an insane society going to war. Well, you know, do you ever see yourself as Shrike? Ahab, now. Ahab is another thing. Ahab and Moby Dick was the... Of course, there's a lot of interpretations of Ahab, but one of the most probably prevalent interpretations is Ahab pursuing that thing. You know, the thing that's inside of all of us? That thing we're searching or you think you might discover, or that unbelievable happiness or that fantastic insight or whatever it is that man is pursuing. And one day it'll come. And you'll be there. You will have caught it. Well, that's part of it. Also, part of Ahab's problem is the attempt to defeat laws which exist outside of his own nature. The attempt to say, I will stop time, for example. I will not grow old. Or I will not die. I will never die. I'll live forever. Or I'm going to make the earth square. It's going to stop being round. And so we all have the desire to do that. You know, we all have the desire to not grow old, for example, Ed, you know, to stop growing older or to never die or one thing or another. Well, Ahab tried it, and the whale bit not only his other leg off, but that was the end of him. Well, so do you ever think of yourself as a symbolic character in your life? Well, I remember one time, this was just about the time I had seen a movie that delineated this particular phase of existence. And only within the last 3 days did I realize what I was in, what I existed in. At that moment, what a great, majestic short story it would have made. I don't know. I don't know what makes the writer's mentality, what makes the mentality of the average walking around non-seeing, non-observing person. Nobody knows quite where they... Speaking of the non-seeing, this is WOR AM and FM New York. And boing, we'll be here until they catch up finally, until 1 o'clock. This is WOR. the wavering voice at 710 there, the nervous radio station. It's the only radio station that actually is worried. All the other radio stations are your friend, or they're the fun station, or they're the station for time and temperature. This is the station that worries. All the way down to the last man on this station, we're worried. Oh, we're worried more than you can ever guess. You have no idea. It's a long, dark, sinister night outside of the Casbah. And there, a tiny figure, fresh out of Hammond, Indiana, cutting plainly, knife-like, shark-like, through the Stygian Middle Eastern darkness. There he stood, wearing his beanie, waiting for action. In the Casbah, Twang, Hogan Twanger. Well, I was there, and I did that. Om swalalalala bakshish sai bala tungalawaya bakshish. Reaching into his pocket, finding he had only a 7-drop-nick mark left to take him back all the way to the airport and to Tanya's house later that night, he nodded somnolently, indicating, me too, beggar. Me have no dough, no kale. And for the first time, the young, friendly citizen of Indiana felt the curse of the ancient Middle East descending upon his brow like a terrible dark green mold of some antique, dank, Stygian, rotten, purescent civilization. The touch of the ancient curse was upon his soul. Thinking quickly, he said to himself, I must get to Tanya's house. I must get to Tanya's house before it is too late. I must. Looking behind him, he saw a scurrying figure darting from doorway to doorway, pursuing him relentlessly. The glint of steel in the flickering lights of the ancient street lanterns showed that the man behind him was well armed with a curved Damascus scimitar. Fingering the Diners Club card in his pocket quickly, frantically, he realized that it was now or never. He was going to put the Diners Club people to their final supreme test. Would this beggar take Diners Club credentials? Would he borrow 15 drobniks on credit? Then a thrill of sheer terror struck through the marrow of his bones. He realized that he had come out into this dark, Stygian, swirling, orchid-smelling, purescent, stinking Middle Eastern night. Unarmed, he had come out without his ballpoint pen. He had come out unable to sign his Diners Club card. Gangalawa! Want to hear the rest of this story, do you? I could tell you the rest of it because it was a wild thing that happened in the Beirut airport later on that night after a fist fight on the road to Damascus. Oh. Yeah. You don't think it happened to me, do you? You should see the notations on my passport. There's a lot of places I can't go anymore by mutual consent. It's one thing. Well, you want to hear about your life as a short story? Well, let me tell you about this moment of revelation. Speaking of a sinister, oh yes, here, bring it on, Eddie. Wait here, hold it on here. I'll do this. Here, this Emily Quo will like this. All right, get ready. All right, Eddie, sinister oriental music. Hit it.
Grand Shanghai, a great Shanghai restaurant, is the oldest and largest Shanghai restaurant in all of New York, established almost 10 years ago to serve the many North Chinese students and diplomats who remained here in America after communist takeover of China. Great Shanghai. These students needed place to gather for parties, weddings, and other social functions, and they had a longing for the flavors of the Northern Chinese cooking. Great Shanghai. Because China is so large, there are many trials of Chinese cooking. Great Shanghai specializes in Northern Chinese and Shanghai cooking. Hola, ho, hi, bring my hey, Eddie, hey, hey, whoa, 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 bring the love.
Yes. Hey, if you've never had Shanghai cooking, you know, this is the great Shanghai we've been doing here. If you have never had Shanghai cooking, you know, it's funny how little people in this country know about Oriental cooking, and I'm not going to go into a long waltz and thing about Oriental cooking, but it is tremendously varied and extremely, to me, interesting and wildly satisfying. And most of the Oriental cooking that we settle for in this country is just, well, it is the equivalent of settling for diner hash house stuff. If you were to take a foreigner and try to introduce him to American cooking, I doubt whether you'd take him to a rotten stainless steel roadside diner. Well, that is roughly what you do when you go to the average, chop suey joint, literally. That is really the kind of food in China that you're eating. I would like to recommend, if you've never tried really fine Cantonese cooking, really fine Shanghai cooking. Shanghai is a very special thing. Shanghai cooking is like an island in China. I would suggest you try the Great Shanghai.
Broadway between 102nd and 103rd Street. Broadway, I repeat, between 102nd and 103rd Street. Great Shanghai, Great Shanghai. Don't you worry about all the Shanghai restaurants in all of New York.
All right. I make the world's worst Oriental. No, not a terrible Oriental. I'll tell you, though, to defend myself, most Orientals make very bad Indianans. They just don't cut that Indiana accent. I'm sorry. I've known several who've tried to pass, and it just doesn't work. I can spot them in a minute, you know. It's the way they pronounce the R's.
Doingabala, me from Indianapolis, doing.
Just doesn't quite do it. I'll go along with jokes. Speaking of jokies, as long as we're going to go into this problem of approaching your life as a short story, most of us today are so conditioned by drama or of one kind or another that I really foresee the day when there will be a time, there will be an organization, Ed, there will be a place where you can go where they will give you a character to portray. Literally a character. You know, there's too much hit or miss producing of characters. I mean, look how you turned out. And if you had known, and if somebody had helped you, you could have turned into George C. Scott. Or you could have turned into even Olivier. Look what you turned into. Look at you. If you had any kind of help, if you had any kind of little work, a little push here and there, a little coaching, a little expert advice, and a little good writing, along the line, you could have turned into something, really. You could have become, wouldn't it be better to act like, say, to be Nehru, we'll say, or to portray Adlai Stevenson. Wouldn't you like to be the Adlai Stevenson of the 23rd floor, mildly beneficent, yet totally liberal and kindly and friendly and avuncular, and at the same time with an implied, avuncular means like an uncle, and at the same time with implied great wisdom and tolerance. Would you like to have that? And you could develop, of course, along with it goes makeup. They will give you a makeup. They will tell you how to dress. Dressing is not so simple when you're playing a character. You've got to have the properly, badly matched socks. No, really, that's part of it. You've got to have a bad tie. There will be eventually, I believe this, I believe the clothing stores will, in the end, go out of business. They will be replaced by costumers. And on every At every great costumer's place, there will be a costume designer and a costumer where you will come and he will assay your character. Let's see, you're the kindly, friendly, middle-aged, deep-thinking man of liberal tendencies who, from time to time, senses a joke in the air and smiles enigmatically. Well, let's see. Over here, would you bring that rack of tweed jackets, Fred, please? And while you're at it, I want the low-cut loafers, the ones that are scuffed. Yeah, left the scuff there, yes. And bring some pipes, please. Makeup man, come over here, please. Bring your friendly kit. Well, they'll make us up, you see. They'll put little bags under right eyes because it's already starting, you know. Guys are now having their hair dyed silver. Guys who are callow youths and who are being laughed at around tables and agencies, now they're having their hair dyed. They're having little padding put there various places, like they put a little fat on in different places. Yes, you see, it's all part. You're playing the role, you see. And eventually, I'm really serious, eventually people will, looking for total security, will realize that most lives are lived hit or miss. A guy's thrown out in the world just like that. He starts walking around scratching and spitting. He goes to school. I mean, you know, he flubs along in school, not knowing that if his life was programmed, he could make the most out of all of that stuff. Really, seriously. Just think, if you had it to do all over again, think of the great stories you could tell about being thrown off the football team. Had you known that it would have been great to have been thrown off the football team. This is a very important point I'm making, that lives are lived hit or miss. And today, as you know, there is a great drive towards total security, and that follows much more than just on the security of money. That's kid stuff, having a place to live when you're old. I'm talking about using your life as a part to play. There is, in the current issue of Life magazine, talking about life, is one of the scariest articles I've read in a long time. It's a profile of a teenage girl in high school and her attitudes, and she's a cheerleader and the whole jazz, all of it, the song leader, whatever they call it. She's everything. She's made it all the way. Any of you women who are curious about why men today are feeling nervous around women, I would suggest you read this article. And one key line, this girl regards men largely as accessories, social accessories, and they are largely indications of her popularity. Well, it's not easy being an accessory. I'm telling you that, because an accessory has a very different function than a secondary member of society. Now, there was a day when women were considered not as good as men, but nevertheless, they were never considered accessories. Well, now, an accessory is expendable, you know. The word accessory means just, you know, a little thing you attach on the outside. It's something that you can use if you want to, and if you don't want to, you can get along very well without it. Well, this is a very significant profile of a monster, I believe. I read this thing. It's an intriguing thing. So along the line, you'll find everybody is trying to dramatize himself because it's dull to be just you, literally dull to be you. Wouldn't you rather be Geraldine Page? Of course. There are at least 87 million puerile youths out there who believe they are Holden Caulfield. No, they're not Jimmy Merriweather. They're Holden Caulfield. And even though there's a non-existent Holden Caulfield that they are, nevertheless, they are that. Believe me, I bet there's at least 10 million kids who think they're Alfred E. Newman. It's true. And I don't know how many million. Of course, this is not so much a product of more men. I think men most generally accept themselves for what they are. And this is one of the reasons they write 9 symphonies out of despair over knowing what they are. Men, on the other hand, are influenced by women who do not necessarily at all accept what they are. They're never any acceptance. I'm talking about accept the men for what they are. Women, on the other hand, how they accept themselves, I'm not in a position to argue. But it's produced a kind of showbiz world where guys are playing scenes. Have you ever read, for example, Playboy magazine? Almost every reader in Playboy every month lives a gigantic fantasy where he is this wildly swinging cat who has this sensational apartment on Lexington Avenue, and every night he's making the scene with another actress from the actor's studio. And he has 25 magnificent recipes for Welsh rarebit. And he is a superb wine taster. And not only that, he... on. Now, every college kid, you'll find people live those same fantasies in their political philosophies. There are millions of college kids, and it is a particular type of college mentality, who believes that he is a clean-limbed Superman. Now, the term Superman I'm using in the Nietzschean sense here. I'm not using it in the sense of Superman in the comic book sense. I'm talking about Superman of morality, attitude, Superman of worth. His life is absolutely priceless. His worth, his life is the end product of all of it. And so naturally, in his fantasy, he is always the main hero, the good guy, the deep thinker in the Ayn Rand books. He is never the slob who the deep thinker is fighting. He's always Howard Roark, inevitably. He is never the loutish mob who, just seem to go along and say terrible things with foreign accents. He's never that. And then on the other hand, this can be found in other areas of philosophy. There are certain politicians today, in connection with our discussion last night of pop art, who are dealing in pop politics. Pop politics is another thing now. Pop politics is me good guy, you bad guy politics. This has been always part of our popular fiction. This has always been part of our comic strip tradition of morality. The comic strip tradition where you find a pure, beautiful Little Orphan Annie facing an evil world. And whenever Little Orphan Annie spots trouble, Daddy Warbucks and the Asp come around to decapitate, always with absolute, infallible virtue and justice, the evildoers. And so, naturally, this is found in many forms of political fantasy today. We good guy, them bad guy. Bad guy, good guy. Good guy, bad guy. We good guy, all right. We good guy, we go after bad guy. We kill bad guy because good guy got right to kill bad guy. Because good guy is good guy, bad guy is bad guy. We kill bad guy. And it goes on and on. It's just a kind of a pop philosophy. Well, showbiz has taken over many areas, and it's taken over politics even more than it ever has. Now, when I talk about showbiz, I'm not talking about production of campaigns like parades, torchlight parades, and all that stuff. I'm talking about a showbiz aspect towards the actual political philosophy in the campaigner, the villain. There's always a villain in every movie. Always. And there's no question about who he is. I mean, if it is, it's not going to be a popular movie, I'll tell you that. There's always a good guy in every TV series. Have you ever noticed those guys on speaking of TV series, one of the most interesting new aspects of the TV series is the scowling, unbelievably righteous pursuer of virtue and justice. That is in almost every one of these TV series, ranging all the way from Ben Gazzara, The Defenders, all these guys somehow are at any point, they don't ever seem to be ever objective. They are never objective lawyers. They are avenging angels. That's a very different thing. Heaven help the poor guy who gets in the clutches of E.G. Marshall. All I got to say, heaven help him. He's dead from the very beginning because you know he's going to lose. He's dealing with the forces of good. He's not dealing with the law. He's dealing with something higher than that. But showbiz has slowly seeped in. Listen to this beautiful little ad. It tells you, well, here, even more than that. Give me a little jazzy music here, Eddie. Jazzy. No, that's not jazzy. Eddie, come on, that's Fu Manchu. Wah, 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 wah. Wah, 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 wah. Oh, boy, isn't it a great swinging world? Boston. Life at Boston Advertising Agencies has settled down to a quiet routine now that Sheldon Silk is working. Silk started in on a new job Monday and no longer is making the rounds in search of employment. Receptionists recall the well-dressed young man of 30 carrying an attaché case who breezed in with the pronouncement, my name is Sheldon Silk. The sound of his name triggered a 60-piece orchestra into blaring a gigantic fanfare usually associated with working kings and television guest stars. Silk, who stands a cool 5'7" and is unmarried, is not likely to go unnoticed by receptionists, but he took no chances. He taped the gigantic orchestral fanfare in a portable tape recorder he carried in his attaché case. All he would say would be, I am Sheldon Silk. After the musical equivalent of a 21-gun salute, Sheldon would then say, I want exactly 4 minutes and 17 seconds of your boss's time, please. All right, we ran out of gas. That's how long it took for Sheldon to play his roll of tape, set with music, which Silk had prepared in his effort to land an advertising job. Included in the sales pitch about Silk were two original songs. It's all part of the musical world. Oh, Sheldon, Silk. We're here to sing about Silk, Silk, Sheldon Silk. He's great, he's fine. Hello, Sheldon. Everybody's singing the praises of Shelling. Here comes Shelling. Yes, when things are going bad, when skies are gray, when sales are going down, everywhere, all over town, they're calling the name out, S-H-E-L-D-O-L, Sheldon, Shelley, call me Shelley Silk. Yeah, I'm Shelley, I'm Shelley Silk. What a scene. Including in the sales pitch were two songs sung, of course, by Silk himself. Silk, who lives with his widowed mother in suburban Randolph, Mass., says, well, actually, I'm a very conservative man. My musical approach was a rebellion against the indifference of secretaries and receptionists and doors that are bolted against the worthy job seeker. Well, it's showbiz all over. He's begun to realize that production does it. And he says, he goes on to say here, by the way, he turned out not to get a job through that, but he got a job through a newspaper want ad. But it's a sign of the time. The thing that is important to realize that even though Sheldon did not get a job through this technique, Sheldon did get a wire story, AP, all over the country, and we're talking about him now. Everybody in New York knows the name of Sheldon Silk now. Hi, Shelley. Clunk. Making a scene big. Well, so there are all kinds of ways to infiltrate, and I'm sure that out there in the darkness, a lot of guys are suddenly getting ideas. You see, in his attaché case, he had this loudspeaker and the whole jazz going. You see, yeah, the whole thing going. Well, now, we see ourselves, each one of us, I suspect. Today, it used to be that guys saw themselves living through a series of roles. It's very interesting how people see themselves in relationship to society. If you read the works of Dickens, for example, or any of the 19th century writers, Twain even reflects this. People generally looked upon their life as a kind of progression. And there was a time after a long period of time, work and achievement and one thing or another, you got to be Scrooge. Scrooge did not start out Scrooge, Ebenezer Scrooge, at the age of 19. The stars, Eddie, in those days were always men who had obviously worked a long time to get there. If you read the stories of Twain's Life on the River, he talked about these great river pilots and how long it had taken them to become a river pilot. And by the time they became famous river pilots, they were men not only of maturity and judgment, but great experience. Well, that's all gone down the drain now. Today, we think of ourselves almost from the very moment, and I think it's because of a lot of things, Spock, it's permissiveness in child care. The kid thinks of himself as a star almost from the very instant he is able to walk and talk. He is a star. He is not a featured player. He never sees himself as a guy working his way up from the chorus. And so the little lout at the age of 9, his bedroom is literally a toy store. He is living in a wing of F.A.O. Schwartz. And anything he wants, he gets. And particularly, any attitude he wants to take is condoned. That's far more important than a kid yelling for a toy. You know, a lot of people say, well, no, I don't give my kid everything he wants. Meaning, I don't give him that giant wind-up teddy bear that's 17 feet high that costs $4,000. But, on the other hand, they allow him any attitude he wants, which is even more sneaky and sinister. They allow him any pose he wishes to take. Like, he comes into the living room and he starts to act, and everybody has to stop for 20 minutes while his kid goes through his little comic routine, which he learned from TV. He becomes a star with a built-in, ready-made, very, very disciplined audience from the time he is able to go. If he doesn't get it, then he's being called suppressed then. Well, that's, you know, so all right, he's suppressed. But the question is, what happens later when he becomes really suppressed? Now, that's very interesting. When this kid goes out, he's now 19, you see, he's a star. He is firmly convinced he's a star. He is a star. One thing that begins to, the little cause and effect in his mind, is that people who do not recognize his stardom are slobs. It never could be that he isn't a star, and that maybe they're right. It is that those who do not recognize my intrinsic worth are examples of the rotten holdover from that old Victorian world that did not recognize my value and allow me to swing, and so on, so on. So it's a kind of self-built-in aggrandism. It's very intriguing. What it will result in, no one quite knows yet. No one in the social sciences certainly knows, even though they themselves, in a way, triggered it all off. Certainly the psychologists have their little load of blame to carry, too. Because what was generally considered a cure for one problem resulted in another gigantic problem, which in the end produces some pretty interesting results. Like, for example, a little incident out on Long Island recently. You remember that great Big Deb party? Well, most of the kids involved, and I'm sure, feel if you criticize this thing, it shows that you're not with it. That's all. You're just not with it. This is pretty much the same attitude that held in much of the Nazi youth in the early 20s. When older men said, look, I mean, it's not a good idea to go out and break people's windows. I mean, that's a terrible thing, you know. Well, immediately the old duffer who said that was put down as not being with it. He wasn't part of the brave new order. That's a good word, you know, the new order keeps popping up every 10 or 15 years in the lexicon, in our dictionary. And it takes new ways of saying this. Same thing. There was a letter, for example, to Life. Some chick wrote a letter from a college, and she was objecting that Life objected to the fact that these kids broke up this place. This shows you're 20 years behind the times. And she meant it. Oh, yeah. Well, that's the way it goes. Now, here is part of that scene. Of course, little old Sheldon there. It's not very serious, but there are other things. Here's one. Now, I'd like to... Eddie, get me some... let's see. What do we got in there? No, I guess we don't have the right kind of thing here. I didn't bring it in for this particular piece. But I think showbiz music will do it right here. The first thing there. That's a lot. No, here's an advertisement. It shows this guy standing in front of a gigantic window, and he's looking out over the city. And you see him from behind. And the copy reads, "That man, he has the will and wherewithal to do as he pleases. When he talks, men unconsciously hunch forward to listen. When he looks at a woman, she feels all woman. You may admire him, resent him, but no one can be indifferent to him." There's a great word that used to be used to describe that type. It started with a B. But he's in the ads now, you see, and it's a cologne. This is his cologne, and personal grooming accessories are "That Man" by Revlon. A lusty tang of lemon, tabac, and amber, as different from others as that man is from the run of men. I could just see little skinny Seymour buying his big 2-quart jar of that man, his little myopic eyes watering in the... Yes, there will be a day when I kind of like to start that. Of course, this is all part of the anti-hero. The anti-hero, there's no such thing as an anti-hero. I'm going to take issue with all the writers. That every man is a hero. And he's not an anti-hero at all. What he is every man is anti all the other heroes. Which literally is what it means. And so when you become anti-society, that means you're anti all the other heroes. And so Holden Caulfield is not an anti-hero. Holden is a hero. And all the other people are rotten and are the other heroes. And, of course, so he's putting them down. And each man is that man. Every man is that man. He is admired and feared. Yes, when he speaks, men hunch forward instinctively to listen. Hunch forward. How do you like that word? Hunch forward instinctively to listen. Yes, this is Shep. That man speaking to you from your loudspeaker. I want all of you to hunch forward instinctively. Come on, hunch forward. Now you're listening real, man. I'm going to tell you, we're all going to strike at 8:15. We'll start a great pincers movement. Shut up over there, all of you! And now, come here, baby. You see, when women are spoken to by him, they instinctively feel more woman than ever. Come here, baby. Take a shot of this cologne, baby. This'll do it every time.
Something old.